So like I said, tonight we begin our study on Mormonism. And tonight I kind of want to lay out in this period of structure a little bit of the origin and the history up into basically where I want to cover. And that is, how did the Mormons begin in Palmyra, New York, with this one guy named Joseph Smith, and end up in modern-day Salt Lake City, Utah? What got them there? And talk a little bit about that origin up to that point, because it's a really important origin that we understand how this all came to be. Then we want to talk a little about the structure of the organization. How is it laid out? How is it organized? And then lastly, what are its sources of authority? What are its four primary sources of authority? And we'll examine that tonight. And then next week we'll come together. We'll begin diving into the deep sea of Mormon doctrine and doing our best to try and go through that, weave that together, and then outline how we are to address those things and speak to those things biblically. And I think, you know, a lot of you may be shocked when I say that Islam is infinitesimally closer to Christianity than Mormonism is. But when we actually start looking at the doctrines, you'll go, okay, yeah, I see what he's saying. So obviously we begin here by just, that's a picture of the Salt Lake Temple. Temples are a very important part of Mormonism. It's part of this kind of restored reality. This is where God dwells on earth. This is where the Spirit comes and dwells. This is where all things eternal are sealed on earth by the keys which are held by the priesthood, the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. This is where marriages are sealed for eternity. This is where you can baptize for the dead. There are many things here that happen within these temples, and these temples are meant to kind of seal things which are eternal. And you can only if you're a worthy Mormon can you enter into these. So that would be priesthood holders, worthy priesthood holders, and then females who have gone through bishop interviews and things like that. You know, they'll check. You have to make sure that you have to be a regular tither in the Mormon church and all of these things. You have to uphold the words of wisdom. That is, you can't smoke, can't do tobacco, can't drink caffeine, lots of other little things. You have to be basically just a Mormon who's in good standing, and then you can go into the temple, and that's where you'll go in. You'll be dressed in all white. As they go in there, they have their temple garments. A lot of times you'll see them. A lot of times if you go to like the temple here in Anchorage, you ever see the temple missionaries who kind of run it? They'll usually have like an all-white suit, and the lady will have an all-white dress, and that's their temple garment. So we'll talk a little bit more about the temple probably in our next lecture when we talk about doctrine. But just, I mean, they're beautiful buildings, and like I said, they're some of the most beautiful false idols you'll ever come across. A couple quick facts about Mormonism. It was founded by Joseph Smith Jr. In the year 1830. At the time, it had just really six original members to the church. Its headquarters is in Salt Lake City, Utah. If you've ever been to Utah, it's Mormon Central. And so you're right there in Salt Lake City of Temple Square with the temple we just looked at. Very prominent part of Mormonism. It has almost 20 million adherents worldwide. So this is a huge missionary organization. Primarily, their missionary organization comes to the fact that every 18-year-old male is highly recommended to serve a two-year mission. So they will serve a two-year mission. And today, because most Mormon females are getting married a little bit later on, just kind of as that trend goes across the world, as women are getting married later on, a lot of younger women who are between 18 to 24, or excuse me, 21 and older, are now going on mission. So it's not shocking nowadays to almost find more female missionaries than there are male missionaries, primarily here within America. And usually, not surprisingly, the female missionaries actually have more success. They're usually more mature, they have a little bit more knowledge of the faith. And so you have a 21, 22, 23-year-old female compared to an 18-year-old kind of kid, still boy. And usually they're a little bit more effective in the mission field. So female missionaries are becoming much more common than what they once were. But there are 60,000 missionaries worldwide. And so this is a big thing. They are very missional in that sense. Since its founding in 1830, the LDS Church has had over 125 different factions break off of it. So there are 125 kind of LDS factions or sects here. The largest of those factions is what is known as the RLDS, the Reorganized Latter-day Saints, also known as the Community of Christ. So that is basically individuals who, after basically the third president of the church split off, these individuals believed that Joseph Smith III, Joseph Smith Jr.'s son, was meant to take over the presidency, and that the church was meant to stay there in Missouri, in Independence, Missouri, where it was founded. And this church split off and basically stopped receiving any kind of prophecies from Brigham Young or anything like that. And they reject all of the doctrines of covenants up until 1844. So 1844 was when Joseph Smith's last prophecies, anything after that, all of their current prophets are added to the doctrine of covenants. They reject the Pearl of Great Price, and they use what is called the inspired version of the King James, which is where Joseph Smith went and did all the translations in different areas. And so that is the RLDS. What's interesting about the RLDS, it's basically the liberal sect of Mormonism. They actually ordain females to the priesthood and homosexuals to the church. And so the RLDS is actually pretty much like the far left of the sects, and the far right of the Mormon sect is what is known as the FLDS. And this was led by a man named Warren Jeffs. So you've probably heard of Warren Jeffs, multiple wives, actually just listen to an interview from his 65th wife, I think. It was a pretty fascinating interview. But these are the individuals who basically see everything after 1890 when Wilford Woodruff, who was the president at the time, God condemned polygamy. Basically, from that point forward, they broke away from that and said that the church had gone apostate. And so the FLDS is kind of holds all of the original teachings of the church. They are basically the fundamentalist of the Latter-day Saints. It is a very wealthy organization, and it is well integrated into society. Perhaps that is what has made it so successful. I mean, it is the amount of wealth in the Mormon church is unbelievable. And that's what I think makes it so fascinating. The individuals that are in Mormonism are not like dumb country bumpkins. These are very intelligent people. These are very intellectual. For instance, the current president of the church, Russell M. Nelson, is a renowned surgeon. These people are not like dumb idiots. And that should just go to show us that having your heart open to spiritual truth and cognitive power do not go hand in hand. You can be the smartest person in the world, but if the Lord doesn't open your heart to truth, you'll believe all the lies in the world. And so I just want to remember that these individuals are not stupid. They're not dumb. A lot of times it's easy for us to kind of hear, especially when we get to the doctrinal portions, how in the world could they believe that? How could this happen? These are not dummies. They're just spiritually blind. And that is something that's very important to remember in these realities. They're well integrated into society, specifically through politicians like the Romneys, George Romney, Mitt Romney, these individuals. Ezra Taft Benson was a president of the church, I believe, in the early 90s maybe, or even possibly before then, I remember. But he was a department, a secretary of agriculture. So a lot of these Mormons have integrated in society. And for the most part, especially with the run of Mitt Romney in 2012, most people just kind of have accepted them into the flock. It's almost become just like, oh, they're really nice people, and they vote conservative. And so that's kind of what has been accepted. They're on our side in the pro-life movement, right? Like, this is kind of, we just start accepting people in the flock. And so they're well integrated in society, very wealthy, usually very successful. BYU is becoming a very prominent force in schools and things like that. So with that kind of overview, broad overview of some quick facts of Mormonism, I want to now go to the origin story. How did this all begin? And we have to turn our attention to really its founder, and that's Joseph Smith Jr. Joseph Smith Jr. was born on December 23rd, 1805 in Vermont, and he was the third son of Joseph and Lucy Smith. Now, some interesting facts about Joseph Sr., Joseph's dad, was that he was a mystic. He was a man who spent a lot of his time digging for imaginary buried treasure. This was a common thing during this period. They would use these things like seer stones, which will be very important here in a second, divining rods, talismans, and all of these other things to try and tell people, we can use these occult practices to find buried treasure. To find buried treasure. So one of the things that they would do is, for instance, something that Joseph Smith Jr. would do is he took a fondness to his father's mystical and ritual occultic practices, was they would take these stones and you would place them in a hat and look in a portion of the ground and say that you could see treasure buried. And supposedly you could actually go to the old Smith home nowadays and find large like burial plots where they were like digging up all of these holes of treasure. And so this was a family. Not only was the father given to ritual practices, occult practices, divination, and things like that, and ultimately Ponzi schemes, but also the mother, Lucy, was given to a lot of kind of supernatural stuff. And it's very important to remember, the mid-19th century gave to this period of a lot of kind of occultic divination and ritual practices within America. It became a kind of a hobby. For instance, we see this all the way into the late 19th century with individuals like, Abraham Lincoln's wife was given into divination. Abraham Lincoln actually lost one of his sons, and throughout that, Mary Todd would often try to summon up the spirit of her son. And so this was a common kind of ritual occultic practice during this period, and the Smiths were very much given into it. In 1826, Joseph Smith Jr. was actually arrested for basically being a disorderly and person and an imposter. And this came when he basically signed a contract with one Joseph Stoll and said that through these seer stones, he had found a secret silver mine. And Stoll signed a contract saying, okay, I'll pay you money to use whatever you need to go and get the silver mine. Ultimately, it ended up showing to be a fraud. Stoll reported Smith, and Smith was arrested for being an imposter. This is an example of a seer stone. And this is the seer stone that is actually in the archives of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This is the seer stone that Joseph Smith put in this hat and said that looking through his hat, he was able to interpret the golden plates of the Book of Mormon, along with what is known as the Urim and Thummim. Now, the Urim and Thummim was what he called, was said, was a breastplate that had these spectacles attached to it, and he could read the plates through that as well. Now, many believe that the Urim and Thummim actually never existed, that he utilized the Urim and Thummim, which was the breastplate worn by a Levitical priest in the Bible, in order to try and get away from this seer stone reality. That everybody knew these individuals were called glass lookers or peep stones. And people began to realize that this was a scheme and a fraud. So many think that in order to try and keep people away from worrying about how these translations came, that he created this biblical term, he adopted this Urim and Thummim, and basically that's what he was referring to when it came to the seer stone, to try and make people feel a little bit more authentic. Oh, that's a biblical thing that he used to interpret, when in all reality, this is what's there. It's just this egg-looking seer stone. This brings us to Smith's first vision, really a central part of the church. In 1817, when Joseph was 11, the family settled near Palmyra, New York, not far from present-day Rochester. A few years later, most of the members of the family had joined the Presbyterian church there, but Joseph basically relays that he was undecided over them. This was a time of great kind of spiritual awakening. We're talking about getting into the second great awakening period of America. This area in upstate New York is what is known as the burnt-over district. The burnt-over district was the reality of a lot of these were man-made revivals. And you had many preachers, especially in this period, that were trying to create greater revivals. How can I outdo the last one? And so with this, it kind of created this kind of hyper-spiritualism, hyper-charismaticism. This was a very religious and superstitious time in this area. And supposedly Smith argues that it was during this period that he became unsettled while all of his family had joined this Presbyterian church, that he just didn't know which one of the groups there to join. There was so much strife, he said, among the denominations that he felt he couldn't decide who was right and wrong. According to Smith, however, this great problem of who to choose, because I know every 11-year-old battles with which church should they belong to, and he did, obviously. And so he's struggling, and then 3 years later, God gave him an answer. God showed up. In 1820, God showed up and gave him what we call the first vision. This story of Smith's first vision is found in the Mormon sacred book known as the Pearl of Great Price. And it supposedly occurred in 1820 when Smith was 14 years old. And this is directly verbatim for what comes out of the Pearl of Great Price. He says, while puzzling about which church to join, Smith read James 1:5. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Smith writes, quote, I retired to the woods, knelt down, and began to pray. Suddenly, two personages appeared. One of them pointed to the other and said, this is my beloved son, hear him. In answer to the question as to which of the sects was right, the one personage who had addressed me said that I was to join none of them, since, quote, they were all wrong, and since, quote, all their creeds were an abomination in his sight, end quote. Sorry, Freddie. That's going to ruin your study. That, in fact, those professing their faith in these various sects were, quote, all corrupt and hypocritical. A lot of times, people will get angry and say, you know, why are you doing the classes like this? You know, why are you attacking or undermining Mormonism? Don't you have better things to do? Well, the reality is Mormonism attacked Christianity first. This is the reality of what we're seeing here is first two very important things in this first vision. One, he says that he sees two personages. This is relating to God the Father and God the Son. Joe Smith teaches that God the Father, Elohim is his name, has a physical body. He has a physical body, bones and flesh. He is a glorified man. Jesus Christ is the incarnate Son in the body, and he is there with him. These two personages. So, secondly, all of Christianity is wrong. Every group is wrong. Every sect is wrong. All of it has fallen into apostasy. And this is a central part of Mormonism. Universal apostasy. Central to Smith's first vision and a key claim of Mormonism is that after the death of the apostles, the church went into an immediate and universal apostasy. This was why they claim there needed to be a full restoration, not a reformation. A reformation says the truth is there, we simply need to reform ourselves to the truth that exists in the scriptures. That's what Luther called the church to do. Get back to the truth that has been delivered once and for all. Restoration says the truth has disappeared. It's gone. It's fallen off the map. It's fallen off the face of the world. And it needs to be brought back. It needs to begin back. Without a universal apostasy, the need for a restored church under Joseph Smith would be both needless and false. Now that's important because Mormons today have changed their tune. Bruce R. McConkie, one of the leading Mormon scholars back in the old times, wrote absolutely, he wrote that the Roman Catholic Church was the whore of Babylon and all of the Protestant churches after her were her whorish daughters. That's real Mormonism. Like that's the kind of Mormonism I like because at least it's honest. Like that's what they're down to, right? Most Mormonism today says, no, we're just one of you guys. We're just one of you. We just have a few differences. We're like Methodist and Baptist. We're just a few differences. You're looking at these things. This is the reality. We're not nowhere near as far. But the problem is what that claim is, and this is what I always try to tell them. If you're not the one true church, then the vision given to Joseph Smith was both needless and false. And your whole system falls apart if you're just trying to be like us. And so you're either the one true church or we're the one true church. There is no in between. There is no gray area. Now, our study through church history, the beauty of following this up after church history, is we've seen there was no universal apostasy. Yes, there were rough times. Yes, there was at one point where it seemed like the majority of the church was Arian, but there was always an Athanasius. There was always a remnant of truth in the church. No matter when the church has been or existed, no matter how dark it may seem at its highest levels, there was always a faithful remnant that God has preserved from the very beginning. The church has never gone into universal apostasy. Oftentimes they will use texts from Scripture which talk about the end times there being an apostasy, a falling away, but they don't realize that those things are never referring to a universal apostasy. Simply the reflection that false teachers would arise in the last days, which they themselves are a part of. And this is the reality. So either Orthodox Christianity is false or Mormonism is false. There is no other option. And so immediately when that conversation starts going, well, we're kind of just like you guys. That's not what Joseph Smith taught. That's not the vision that God gave Joseph Smith according to your own doctrine. So it's either you're false or we're false. There is no in between. So that's a very important thing. There was no universal apostasy. There has always been a faithful remnant because that faithful remnant belongs to a faithful God. This goes right along with a nighttime visit. So after that, about 3 years later, Joseph Smith, basically, what's interesting, he has that vision at 14, and he goes right back to like doing the stuff with his dad and the superstitious divining rod. So like, I guess he just wasn't that affected by it too big. But 3 years later, he gets another vision. And this time, he gets a vision from an angel named Moroni, who was a glorified man from a glorified son of one Mormon, which is where we get the Book of Mormon from. The Moroni was Mormon's son. Mormon is a character, as well as Moroni, in the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith writes, "A personage appeared to me at my bedside who was glorious beyond description. He said that he was a messenger sent from the presence of God and that his name was Moroni, that God had worked for me to do and that my name should be had for good and evil among all nations, kindreds, and tongues. He told me that a book had been deposited, written on golden plates, giving an account of the former inhabitants of this continent and containing the fullness of the everlasting gospel as delivered by the Savior to the ancient inhabitants of this land. He also said that there were two stones in silver bows, and these stones fastened to a breastplate constituted what is called the Urim and Thummim, deposited with the plates, adding that God had prepared these stones for the purpose of translating this book." We're told that the angel appeared to him, Moroni appeared to him two more times that night, repeating the same message. The next day, Smith continues, "I went to a hill outside the village where we lived called the Hill Cumorah and found the golden plates deposited in a stone box with the Urim and Thummim and the breastplate. I was not permitted to take them out at this time, however, but was told by the angel who had appeared that I should come back to this place every year at this time for the next 4 years. Finally, however, on September 22nd, 1827, I was given the plates by the heavenly messenger with instructions to keep them carefully until he, the angel, should call for them." So basically, for the next 4 years, he's supposed to come back to this spot, and finally the angel will tell him when he can finally take them. Now, Smith is into his 20s, and this is what happens. Now, there's some major problems with these accounts. The account was written by Smith much later. It wasn't written until 1842. So supposedly, the first time these vision accounts are even written are 15 years after the last time when Moroni actually gives him the plates. And the first vision was published in the 1851 version of the Pearl of Great Price. Now the problem was, in the account of the very first vision, we were told that it was Nephi rather than Moroni who visited him. Nephi is another character of the Book of Mormon. So later on, it's revised, and it was actually, the angel's name was Moroni. It wasn't Nephi. That wasn't it. But the very first publishing we have has it as Nephi being the one who visited him, not Moroni. Moreover, in the first edition of the Pearl of Great Price in 1851, Smith mentioned that he had only been visited by one personage, not two. What's interesting is you can already see the development within Smith's own doctrine. When you read the Book of Mormon, what's fascinating is it's very monotheistic. It's very monotheistic. You know why? Because he copied the Bible in like a bunch of places. So he's copying the Bible, he's carrying over this monotheism from Scripture, but then as he begins developing his own doctrines, you begin seeing the polytheism created. When he can't square the Trinity, when he can't provide any kind of biblical language to teach the Trinity, which isn't shocking when you abandon all the creeds and confessions that help you do that. But when you do that, here he's not able to do that, and so I think he begins to just outright reject it and teach new views of God. It's important to remember that Smith had no kind of training in biblical theology or anything like that. So there were some major discrepancies. There are multiple revisions of the first vision account, and so you can see where there's issues. When your entire system is built on the testimony of this vision, and there's multiple revisions of that, and changes and contradictions, that becomes a major issue. Smith gets married and he ultimately moves to Pennsylvania. He was married in 1827 to Emma Hale of Harmony, Pennsylvania, and having eloped with her because her father actually refused to allow her to marry. Now, Smith argued that it was because he was just mad because Smith was getting all these visions from God. And so the dad was like frustrated and a bit jealous about that, and there was persecution. However, Fallon Brody, a historian in her biography of Joseph Smith, gives documentary evidence to prove that the real reason for Mr. Hale's refusal was that at this time Smith's only occupation was that of digging for money with the help of a peepstone, into which he would gaze to determine the location of a treasure. Now, you have to see the connection here. The very means by which the man claims to have translated the Book of Mormon is the very means by which he runs Ponzi schemes to say he finds treasure in the ground. That's a devastating connection. And this was happening all the way up into the beginning portions of the translation period. Smith goes on to tell us that because of the persecution which followed his reception of the plates, he decided to move to the house of his wife, father, in Pennsylvania. He actually went supposedly and told of a Methodist minister at this time about his vision. And the Methodist minister straight up told him that was from Satan. Your vision was from Satan. That was devil. The devil goes around like an angel of light. And that's what you've seen. I actually think that minister was probably very right in that sense. But this was the kind of persecution that Smith often was spoken of, was just kind of being mocked by the religious leaders of a town. Like, this man is just, he's crazy. He's cuckoo. A New York farmer interested in funding the publication of the Book of Mormon came into life, and that man's name was Martin Harris. Now, Martin Harris was told by Smith that the plates were in Reformed Egyptian. That's what he said these were. We'll talk about the issue with that here in a second. And he was given characters, supposedly from the Book of Mormon, to go and take to this renowned Egyptologist there at Columbia University in New York, to go and see if they were real. This man's name was Professor Charles Anthon. Now, Harris claimed that the Egyptian translator, Charles Anthon, told him that these Reformed Egyptian characters were more correct than any other translation of Egyptian he'd ever seen before. However, there's a big problem with that. The moment that that began to be circulated by the church as a means of trying to gain and market people to come and hear what the Book of Mormon taught, Charles Anthon actually found out that his name was being used. And so immediately he wrote a letter about claiming that he denied that the plates were written in Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics because he said such a language doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as Reformed Egyptian. This was the world's renowned Egyptologist at the time. There's no such thing as Reformed Egyptian. Not only that, but he talked about how Harris came to him multiple times offering him money to give a note of authenticity. But Harris would actually never let him see the plates. And so the man told him, I wouldn't do that. And when he asked Harris, well, why can't I see these plates if they're real? I want to see them if these things exist. Harris said that if he were to show them, he would bring the wrath of God upon himself. So obviously that's why. And he said, well, if I show you, would you be willing to take the wrath of God on you? And Anthon, who was and major agnostic said, sure, I'll take it on me. I don't care. Just bring me the plates. Nevertheless, that never happened. And the man refused to do it, refused to give any kind of authentication, and said that this was an absolute fraud. These characters were anything from Egyptian or any kind of hieroglyph. And so right there from the beginning, we're already starting to see this constant unfolding of evidence showing kind of the fraudulent nature of all of this taking place. Oliver Cowdery enters the picture. Now, Cowdery was a distant relative of Smith. He was his mother, I think, third cousin. And he was a school teacher from Palmyra who, through letters from Joseph Smith's dad, had become interested in these plates. He's like, wow, these plates and visions are supposedly happening. You know, Joseph Jr. seeing angels, and I'm interested to see what this is all about. So suppose he heads down to Pennsylvania, and there he came to investigate, and supposedly within 2 days, he began translating into English what Smith was supposedly interpreting. Now, once again, the interpretation process would go like this. Smith would sit on one side of the table, and Cowdery would sit on the other, and there was a sheet in between them, supposedly. And what Smith supposedly did was he would put the seer stone in his hat, set them upon the plates, and then he would translate out what was being given to him, and Cowdery would then just write that down. And supposedly, this is how this translation process went. We are told that in May of 1829, the two men went into the woods to pray, and while they were praying, a heavenly messenger who identified himself as one John the Baptist, you may have heard of him, he descended and conferred upon both Oliver and Smith the priesthood of Aaron, also known as the Aaronic priesthood, which they say was lost with the universal apostasy. So the Aaronic priesthood was lost. John the Baptist comes in this kind of body part personage. He comes down, he lays his hands on their head and confers upon them the Aaronic priesthood. From that, we are told that both of them now began to prophesy and to understand the true meaning of scriptures. Shortly after, it's claimed that the Melchizedek, or higher priesthood, was also conferred upon Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery at a place along the banks of the Susquehanna River by the very apostles Peter, James, and John themselves. They came and they gave them the Melchizedek priesthood. Okay, priesthood. We're not going to go into the full depth here. We will win our doctrine section. But just to give you kind of an overview. The Aaronic priesthood, they argue, is the priesthood which was carried over from the Old Testament. The priesthood which was given to Aaron himself and Aaron's sons. The Aaronic priesthood is the entry priesthood of the Mormon church. And so you can gain the Aaronic priesthood at the age of 12. All worthy boys are given the Aaronic priesthood at the age of 12, and they usually are given it anywhere between the age of 12 to 17. The places that you can be with the Aaronic priesthood are a priest, a teacher, a bishop, and a deacon. Those are the four areas of that. And they usually are all boys, with the exception of the bishop. We'll talk about bishops when we talk to the structure here in a second. The Melchizedek priesthood is the priesthood which Christ bears. And ultimately, everyone who bears the Melchizedek priesthood bears the power that Christ had on earth. Christ's power came through his priesthood. God the Father's power came through his priesthood. For instance, it is taught in the book of Abraham that God created, and the book of Abraham is in their pearl of great price. I have to make sure I'm clear with the language here. That God the Father, Elohim, created the heavens and earth through his priesthood power, through his Melchizedek priesthood. And so the priesthood is where the keys of authority are established. Only men can have the priesthood, we're told, and that ultimately it is the priesthood power that is what, if one maintains their priesthood and lives in full concordance with their priesthood power, is sealed in the temple, maintains obedience to the law, then that man, that person who holds the Melchizedek priesthood, will one day ascend and progress to being a god himself. And so the priesthood holders, the priesthood is the means by which you are progressed. It is the very power of God on earth, is the priesthood. And so that is, now we'll talk about the falsehoods of their understanding of the priesthood and why the scriptures teach in the priesthood of all believers, and that there is only one who has ever held the priesthood of Melchizedek, and that is Christ and Christ alone. So we'll talk about that in the doctrinal portion, but that just gives you an idea of these distinguishing concepts of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood. This led to what we call the testimony of the three witnesses. Smith had been told that he was not allowed to show the plates to anyone except to certain witnesses who were to be designated by divine revelation. And Joseph Fielding Smith, who was a prophet later on down the line, tells the story of these three witnesses. And you'll find the account of three witnesses in every official copy of the Book of Mormon. As soon as you open it up, it'll say the testimony of three witnesses, which means to testify of the validity of the three witnesses. After the translation of the Book of Mormon had been completed, the following three men desired to be witnesses of the golden plates: Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris. These three men went out into the woods with Smith, knelt in prayer, and suddenly an angel stood before them holding the plates in his hand and turning them leaf by leaf. Now, just an interesting note, two of the three original witnesses recanted of their testimony: Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer. So now Cowdery came back in basically because he had been shunned from his community later, but originally he recanted and a few years later was rebaptized back into the Mormon church, even though him and Brigham Young never got along again after that. Apparently not satisfied with merely the witnesses of three men, Smith later called eight other witnesses to view the plates and to give their testimony. Testimony which one will also find in the authentic copy of the book. So you'll also see what was called the testimony of the eight witnesses who also say they saw the golden plates during this period. And there's lots of evidence out there that there's some fraudulent nature, that many of these individuals have been shown to be frauds and skeptics as well. But there's countless books out there. I recommend, you know, obviously Walter Martin's book, Kingdom of Cults. Anthony Hockham has a great book on Mormonism. James White's Letter to a Mormon Elder. There's just so many books that you could go through. The Religion That Started in a Hat is another great apologetic work. I mean, there's so many good works on this that we'd be basically reinventing the wheel. So ultimately, the Book of Mormon is finished. And with that, the Latter-day Saints, the Church of Latter-day Saints, which was originally titled the Church of Christ, but was then changed to the Church of Christ, or Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, because there was another movement called the Church of Christ led by the Campbellite movement. And so there was a bit of a conflict there. And you want the one true church to stand out. So that was the idea. We got to get a good name. So that's what happens. On March 26, 1830, the Book of Mormon, now complete, was first placed on sale in the Palmyra bookstore, and the first printing was financed by Martin Harris, who had to mortgage his farm in order to pay for it. On April 6, 1830, at Fayette, New York, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was officially organized. The same year, the church was incorporated. There were six members at first, the oldest being only 31 years of age. And Smith and Cowdery ordained each other as elders. And so they ordained themselves as elders of the church, which is the initial placement of a Melchizedek priesthood holder. Every Mormon missionary, when you see elder so-and-so, is a Melchizedek priesthood holder. That's why they bear that name, elder. They have the initial stage into the Melchizedek priesthood. Within a month, the number of members jumped to 40. And then began the Great Migration. The beginning, the Migrate West. Sensing a mission to American Indians, and why not? Your whole book is about Jesus Christ's mission to American Indians, so we need to go do missionary work to American Indians. The small group of Mormons moved to Kirtland, Ohio, near present-day Cleveland. Now, I personally believe this idea of missions to American Indians was merely a cop-out. I think there was a major amount of people running of Smith out because of his false teachings, because of his Ponzi schemes, and because of other things. And a prophet is not accepted in his own hometown, especially when you're a false one. So this was the reality. I think he was getting forced out. And so the idea of doing missionary work among the American Indians really kind of helped give a good idea to cause a lot of people to begin migrating. A prominent Campbellite preacher there, a man named Signe Rigdon, really provides, I think, kind of the early biblical force behind Mormonism. Rigdon was actually a preacher, a Church of Christ preacher, and so he was able to take what Smith was kind of coming up with and actually apply it with some kind of proof texting and really weird manipulating of Scripture. But he at least had the biblical wherewithal to try and like go to people who were predominantly raised in a Christian household. And so he basically converted his whole church to Mormonism, and that really created kind of this kind of big movement that was happening there. In Kirtland, the first Mormon temple was erected, and not all was a story of success. However, severe persecution broke out as the group experienced opposition from non-Mormon neighbors. The primary reason for this was because of there was already rumors of polygamy that was happening there, and we know that this was very much the case. We know that at his death, Joseph Smith had over 48 wives. So we're talking 48 wives at the time of his death. There was already polygamy being practiced. Not only that, the major issue that was happening was a fear of treason. We'll see a little bit later why, but many of the quorum of the early church, I think it was the quorum of 50, was teaching that Smith had received the ultimate king, the ultimate keys of the kingdom, and was thus king over this earth. And so there was fear of the kind of a treasonous coup that may rise up from this group. So there was a lot of issues politically, religiously, that caused people to be very weary of this group and kept kind of forcing them on. Many of Smith's followers left Kirtland and plotted farther west to Jackson County, Missouri, where many settled in the city of Independence. Now there's another branch, another sect of Mormonism called the Church of Latter-day Saints Temple Plot. And this group believes that Independence, Missouri is still Zion. It's here. This is where Jesus Christ is going to come back and start his millennial reign. Right here, Independence, Missouri. This is where it's going to happen. And the group that holds to that still is the Church of Jesus Christ in Temple Plot, because they believe the Temple Plot is going to be built there in Independence, Missouri. Here, Smith received another of his many revelations. He declared Jackson County as being the promised land or the new Zion. Now, already, we're starting to start seeing the false prophecies come in. This is where it's going to be. Now, the Temple Plot says this prophecy is still going to happen. But those who have now look at Salt Lake City as the new Temple Plot, this would have to be a false prophecy and thus ultimately annul any sort of belief in anything that Joseph Smith taught. We're told in Deuteronomy 18 that if a false prophet prophesies false on anything one time, all of his stuff is to be seen as a lie and not from God. And so this is a major issue that goes throughout Joseph Smith's life. By 1839, there were several thousand members living in and around Independence, Missouri. So it is growing fast. Now, what led to the growth of Mormonism? I think two things primarily. One, it was male-dominated in a time of absolute patriarchalism. The Wild West of the 19th century was about as male-dominated and opposed to the old Puritanism of their forefathers as there ever was. Men were going west to get away from what they saw the Puritan nature of New England society. Men like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, these were men who wanted to pave their own way. And I can tell you what, the moral ground in the West was not very moral at all. It was full of saloons and gun battles and prostitution. And these men kind of wanted their own thing. And this provided some sense of structure and a religion that not only was dominated for maleness and sense of the realities of polygamy, but also you can be a god. Is there ever a religion that pleases the sinful nature of man more than to say, you can be God, a God? And so I just think the reality of one, the way that it appeals to the greatest reality of our sin, that's pride, the desire to be God. And then the reality that it fit perfectly within a white male dominated structure of the West, that is what made this become so rampant and movement. Plus, Smith was a charismatic leader, a powerful leader, a very handsome man, was able to woo, and that's why a lot of women were moved into this as well. Plus, with the way in which the community was very caring at this time, very sold out for one another, a lot of orphans, or a lot of widows, I should say, ladies that had maybe lost a husband in a war or battle, they kind of got sucked up in this movement because there was a place that they got care. And that was an area that the church during that period was failing. who was failing to care for a lot of orphans and widows. And because of that, these groups that kind of rose up that had that caring sentiment about them were able to bring in many, sadly. But I think those are a lot of the reasons, and I'm sure there's many more, but some of the major reasons of what led to this kind of growing movement that was happening there. Let's see, where was I? So with growing hostility from the inhabitants of Jackson County, Smith ultimately had to move once again. And this time, they go from Independence, Missouri, to a place called Commerce, Illinois, which he renamed as Nauvoo. There you can go and see the Nauvoo Temple today. It's still there, and this is a big issue there. It became one of the largest cities in Illinois. It was granted a charter, and Smith was actually named mayor. What's interesting is both Democrats and Republicans did what they already did. That was, they started to pander to this new group to get votes. It was a large group, so they started to figure, how can we pander to this group? Smith got a kind of a big head, was starting to be seen as a major figure there in Illinois. So in February 1844, Smith decided that his political ambitions needed an expression on a national level and announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States. He didn't do well. We'll just say that. He didn't do well in that, but that's, you can kind of see where Smith's head is. Smith loves the attention. He loves the fame. He loves that he's beginning to get power. And what he was doing there at Nauvoo was creating this kind of theocratic society where he ran it. It was all about him. He was the central figure. It was taking off. The movement was growing, and it was growing to his head. You know, they say absolute or power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And you see that very much in Smith, and especially in his successor, Brigham Young. Some of his Mormon dissenters quickly criticized him, and the Nauvoo Expositor, which was the paper of the town, published material which sharply denounced Smith and Mormonism and had multiple testimonies of people who had already left the movement to talk about some of the inner workings and the polygamy and some of the major other issues that were happening there. On June 10th, 1844, Smith ordered his men to destroy the newspaper press, the Nauvoo, which had just published an article basically showing all of the falsehoods of the movement. He ordered them to crush the news, destroy the newspaper press, and they did when they came, and they broke it down with sledgehammers, and they set the building on fire. Fortunately for the paper, it didn't burn all the way down. Ultimately, the owners complained, accusing Smith of reckless vandalism, and he was imprisoned. He was released on charges was arrested again on charges of treason, and this time with his brother Hiram. And once again, where does this idea of treason come from? It was because the community was now proclaiming him as king over the earth, the king over the nation, that God had given him both spiritual and political authority over the nation as the prophet of God. And so that becomes a big issue there in the West, especially as they're marching towards territory which is not owned by the United States at this point. And so these are all major issues that are going to happen. Is he going to try to turn this area of Illinois away from the Union? Are these things going to happen? So this becomes a major issue. And so he's thrown in jail with his brother Hiram. The two were jailed in Carthage, Illinois, for violating freedom of the press, which was a big thing back then. The First Amendment actually mattered in the 19th century. And so you would get arrested if you burnt down a news site. Who knows? Now the news sites are the ones burning people down. But nevertheless, this is what happened, and you can just see the sway of events. On June 27, 1844, a mob of armed men angrily stormed the prison house and ruthlessly murdered the two brothers. And some of these were ex-Mormons themselves, some of the ones who actually came, this kind of group that came. Now, you know what this did. This made him a martyr. This made him a martyr, and this kind of cemented his legacy. Oh, he's dying for the faith. He's dying for the cause. You know, he's kind of gone out on his shield there. What's an interesting thing is when we look at the testimony of Smith's death, Smith actually gave out the Masonic help signal there in his death. Most of the men there were Freemasons. The overwhelming majority of the early leaders of Mormonism were all Freemasons. And it isn't shocking when we look at the temple that the overwhelming majority of temple rituals are Masonic rituals. The tokens or the handshakes are Masonic. The different passages which go there. The aprons that you have to wear in the temple. These are all Masonic things that are carried over from that. And so it's just an interesting thing. But nevertheless, this made him a martyr, and it really added to the strength of the movement. After Smith's death, the burning question of the day was, who's going to be the new leader? And there was a division that happened right then and there. First, everybody thought it was going to be Sidney Rigdon at first, who was kind of the first counselor of the presidency. So he's basically supposed to be the next in line. And today, that's how it is. Today in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whoever's the president of the church, which right now is Russell M. Nelson, the first counselor of the presidency, which is Dallin H. Oaks today, will take the place of the presidency when he dies. And that was thought, what was thought was going to be. Rigdon is going to step in for Smith. However, Brigham Young said, no, hold on for a second. I'm the president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, which is the next level below the presidency. And he said, the keys belong to the president of the apostles, which he argues for Peter. Right? So now he's using this kind of Petrine apostolic succession. And ultimately, because he was far more charismatic and a lot more powerful, Young was able to kind of win the largest group of the movement. And Young takes the lead as the second president of the Mormon Church. Under the leadership of Young, the church was forced out of Illinois, once again under charges of polygamy and other issues, and in 1846 began its long journey west, not knowing where they were going to go. They landed in what would become Salt Lake City, Utah in 1847. Now, it wasn't Utah at the time. It was still Mexico territory at this period. And originally, Young wanted to work out a deal to where it would become its own sovereign nation, and that nation was called Deseret. So nowadays, if you ever see a thing called Deseret bookstores or something like that, you'll see them a lot in places like Utah. Those are usually like Mormon bookstores. It originally was going to be called Deseret. America's like, yeah, no, and named it Utah after the Ute Indians that existed there. So just a little bit of interesting history. Between 1856 and 1860, some 3,000 converts pushed handcarts from Iowa City, then the end of the railroad, to Salt Lake Valley, a distance of about 1,300 miles. Through Young's leadership, a revolving fund was set up to finance immigration from foreign countries, particularly Great Britain and Scandinavian countries, where they had already begun doing missionary work. They were already sending missionaries to foreign countries at this period. And in 1877, when Brigham Young died, there were 140,000 Mormons in the United States. So within literally 47 years, it had gone from 6 people to 140,000. And so you can just see how big this was. Now, he wasn't favorable to every immigrant. There is what's known as the Mount Meadows Massacre, where Young, even though it's really hard and fuzzy, nevertheless, a bunch of Mormon men killed about 130 pioneers, both men, women, and children. Only the smallest infants were allowed to live, but they just massacred them, because they were getting too close to their territory. And that's what actually made the American government like go, what the heck's going on out there? And wake up and actually send soldiers out there to figure that out. And that's when a lot of the eye began to be turned on Mormonism. That's when America came out and condemned polygamy. It was like, this is evil, this is wrong. And that's when, about 13 years later in 1890, the president then, Wilford Woodruff, said God changed his mind and monogamy was the only way from that point forward. And so these are just some of the major developments that happened there in the West. So that's how it gets there. That's how the church gets to Salt Lake City. A lot of a fascinating origin story. A lot of stuff there. And if we were to try and lay out all of Brigham Young's presidency, we would be on Mormonism for 15 weeks. It's just so much there. But that's how the church goes. Starts from Palmyra and ends up in Salt Lake City. That's how it gets there. So now some of the church organization. How is it laid out? Well, it's a tier factor. You may not be able to read that, but these will be sent out to you. But the highest level there is the first presidency. The first presidency is made up of the president, is the president and the prophet. They're the same thing. The president of the church is the prophet of the church. Right now, that's Russell M. Nelson. And they're in the presidency. They always have two successors, known as their two counselors. And that goes all the way down to the ward level. That's your local bishopric, your local church here. So you have the president and then the first and second counselors. That's the presidency. Underneath him is what is known as the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. These are selected by the church, Melchizedek priesthood holders. These are the apostles today. That's who they are. They have apostolic authority in the church. Under them is the Quorum of the 70. These are the 70 there, and obviously they get their ideas from Jesus sending out the 70. These are those individuals. These are the Quorum of the 70. They're the kind of the next group down. And then you have obviously your general officers, which is like your Relief Society president, which is like the highest female position in the church, your Young Women's Society, primary. So your general officers are usually kind of the higher female ranked areas. You have your presiding bishop. Now under that, you start getting to your local levels. And that is, first you have a stake presidency. Your stake is kind of like a regional supervisor. He ordains all and oversees all of the priesthood within a regional area. So in order to be elder, you have to be basically interviewed and accepted by your stake president, who has the keys to the priesthood over the region. Underneath that is a ward bishopric. Now that's the local church. Anytime you see the local church, they all look exactly the same. Usually brick building, white pillar, no crosses. They don't believe in the cross. They don't want you to see the cross. The cross is bad. It's a torture. Why would you want to look at that? And I just believe it's because they don't know what the cross actually means. But you don't want to look at the cross, so there'll be never a cross. And even on their temples, at the top of the pillar, is the angel Moroni. The golden angel, that's Moroni. That was the one supposedly that gave, that brought the vision to Joseph Smith. And so the ward bishopric. Now, this is an interesting, fascinating part about the ward bishopric. If you go to a Mormon church on any given Sunday, you're going to come in. At the front, you're going to have your ward bishop who's going to sit there, and he's going to have his two counselors, his first counselor and his second counselor. They're going to sit on the side, and they're going to sit there. They may stand up, and they may welcome everyone. Hey, thank you. Usually, it'd be one of the three. They'll come up, and they'll welcome. Oh, thank you for coming. They'll sit down, and then if it's the first Sunday of the month, they will give what is called a testimony meeting, where basically they do what every group that tries to make everyone else believe does. They bring a bunch of people up who give their testimony about why they believe the Book of Mormon is true, why they believe Joseph Smith is a prophet, yada, yada, yada. So people will just start filing up and giving these long, ordained, you know, I know this is true because this has happened. It's just, let's make everyone believe what we're all struggling with, but it's better to hear a lot of people say that they believe it too. So they just start coming up and telling everyone, this is what we believe. This is why we think it's true, and we just know we've felt the burning in our heart. I said the prayer, and I felt the truth. And so that's what happens on the first Sunday. So you may think, okay, well, that's whatever. Well, then every other Sunday after the month, what they do is they give someone in the congregation, a regular lay person, an assigned talk. Maybe it'll be on the priesthood. Maybe it'll be on giving. Maybe it'll be on Joseph Smith. But they'll give a person these kind of, you can talk on this topic, you have 10 minutes. And so the rest of the service, the bishopric sits down, and these people come up and they give their talks. And basically the bishop's job during the Lord's Day is just to make sure the podium's the right height. So he'll sit there and fix the podium up to whoever's coming up and talking. There is no biblical exposition. It's not even Book of Mormon exposition. They don't get up there. They don't open the Bible. There's no teaching. These bishops, these leaders are not biblical or theologically trained, as are none of the priesthood holders. I mean, you have apologists and things like that in the Mormon church who do have these things, but the vast majority of time, these bishop presidents are businessmen, doctors, lawyers, judges, regular, anyday people, construction workers, whatever. They're not biblically or theologically trained. And the bishop, what's interesting about the bishop at the ward level, he has the keys to the Aaronic priesthood. So he is the one who ordains all of the Aaronic priesthood holders in his church, where the one over him, the stake president, is who ordains the Melchizedek priesthood holders. So anytime those boys go to graduate, they have to go up to the stake in order to become confirmed as elder. So just kind of a real interesting hierarchy that's very clear in how they do things there. Man, this went way long. I was going to be like 30 minutes. Okay, sources of authority. It's real quick. King James Version of the Bible. So unlike the RLDS, who uses the Inspired Version, and that's only the Joseph Smith translation of it, they use, the regular Mormons today, utilize just the regular King James Version of the Bible. They argue in Article 8 of their Articles of Faith, we believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it is translated correctly. They do believe the Bible contains errors. They think that it is secondary to all of their other primary sources of authority. The Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, the Pearl of Great Price are all infallible and errant and are needed in order to understand the Bible and to fill in the gaps where the Bible falls short. The RLDS, like I said, uses the inspired text. And in order to understand the Bible, you need the Book of Mormon. You need these other doctrines. You need the Doctrines of Covenant, or you can't properly understand the Bible. The Bible is full of errors, and it is wrong. The Book of Mormon is the most supreme authority in Mormonism. First Nephi 13:28 tells us why. After the book, the Bible, hath gone forth through the hands of the great and abominable church, that's the apostate church, there are many plain and precious things which were taken away from the book. That's the idea. The idea in Mormonism is that the apostate church took a whole lot away from the Bible. It just took all of these things out of the Bible. And the Book of Mormon comes as the second witness which is needed to verify any truth, they say. Because the Old and New Testament don't do that. You need a whole nother book. The Book of Mormon comes and it fills in the gaps where the Bible has fallen short because of the apostate church. Bruce R. McConkie said, quote, "One of the greatest heresies of an apostate Christianity is the unfounded assumption that the Bible contains all the inspired teachings now extant among men," end quote. In other words, every time a Christian says, no, like this is all we need, this is the Word of God, that's just a picture of their apostate nature, their apostate Christianity. Joseph Smith writes, quote, "I told the brethren that the Book of Mormon was the most correct of any book on earth and the keystone of our religion, and a man would get nearer to God by abiding by its precepts than by any other book, including the Bible." It's the second witness of Jesus Christ. That's the argument. Now, what's it about? The Book of Mormon tells of a man named Lehi who was a prophet in Jerusalem. God warns Lehi in a dream that to take his family and leave Jerusalem because the city is going to be destroyed. This happened, supposedly, in 600 BC, right before the fall of Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar in 586. That's when it supposedly happens. He and his family crossed the ocean to the Americas. Yes, this happened. We crossed the ocean in like this period, in like this dinghy. Crossed the ocean, and they get all the way to America. Laman and Lemuel, his oldest sons, don't believe their dad. He's just a crook. He's just a bum. You know, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's making us go across the sea. It's a long trip. We don't like it, right? They are always complaining and have a hard time following God. But their younger brother, Nephi, is full of faith. Sounds like this almost kind of like a Joseph story, but nevertheless, who would get that idea? So Nephi is full of faith. Nephi is chosen by God to lead the family and be their teachers. The brothers of their wives have children and spread out. Laman and Lemuel hate Nephi so much that they want to kill them. The people eventually split into two groups, the Nephites and the Lamanites. Now, how you know the two groups apart is very clear. Because the Lamanites are evil, God turns their skin dark. So that's how the American Indians turned brown, because they were evil Lamanites. Because dark skin in Mormonism is always a product of the curse. That's why black men couldn't hold the priesthood until 1978 when God changed his mind on that too. The idea that God shows no partiality, which we'll look at in the book of Acts next week, is not the case in Mormonism. God is very partial in Mormonism. And he especially hates black skin, or at least he used to. And so that's the way you knew. Nephites were pure white. They were pure and white, and that was a picture of their purity and that God liked them. But the Lamanites were dark-skinned, and that's how you could know they were under the curse of God. These groups were at war time and time again, their faith constantly being tested. After Jesus is resurrected, he appeared to his people in America. That was the other sheep who I must go to that he was talking about when he said that. Not the Gentiles, it was those in America. He teaches them about baptism and forgiveness. He heals their sick and blesses their children. He establishes church. And unlike those in Jerusalem, the people actually listen to Jesus in America. Afterwards, they live in peace for hundreds of years. However, over time, the people once again lose their faith, wiping out the Nephites. Over time, people lose their faith. A war breaks out. This war takes in the place in the Hill Cumorah, where Joseph Smith supposedly found the plates at. It's supposed to be one of the bloodiest battles ever, according to Mormon theologians and teachers, yet archaeology can find absolutely no trace of any battle that took place there, which has made them believe that it didn't actually happen in New York, but somewhere down in Middle America. Moroni was the only Nephite survivor at the time, which is he was the angel that came, and he's the one who hides the plates, which is where Joseph Smith will find them later on. The Lamanites are the ones who survived, and they are the ancestors of the American Indians. So that's how you get Indians here. This is how this came. They are not from Asia and came across that way. That's no way. They're Hebrews. They're ancient Jews. Problems with the Book of Mormon. Lots. But just real quickly. There's no anthropological evidence to substantiate the Native Americans are descended of ancient Jews. Not at all. They are Asian. Asian. I mean, that's just absolutely clear that these people are, Native Alaskans, all of these are coming from Asiatic groups. They are not ancient Jews. That just doesn't work. Secondly, there is no archaeological evidence to substantiate battles, cities, clothing, animals. I mean, they talk about the fact that there were elephants, silk dresses, things like that. There's absolutely zero evidence that any of that has ever existed in the Americas during the period that this was said to have been written. There are at least 27,000 words from the King James Version of the Bible because it's copied a lot from it. Like when you read like the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus gave to the Native Americans, it's just the Sermon on the Mount, copied out of the King James Bible. And we know that it's the case because areas that the King James Bible translators actually got the translation wrong, that got kept in the Book of Mormon. And so God, this perfect work that God gave Joseph Smith through direct translation, was actually wrong on his own translation of what was said originally. So we can tell right from those fact that he carried over errors from the King James that there were direct copying from it. So when he was behind that curtain, he was likely just copying portions of the scripture. Contradictions and false teachings. For instance, I'll just give you one, lots of them. 2 Nephi 3:11 through 16 predicts that the coming of Joseph Smith will come from the loins of one Joseph, son of Lehi. And yet in the same book, in the Book of Mormon 6:11, all of Lehi's descendants are wiped out. So Joseph writes a prophecy that he's going to come from one Joseph from Lehi, but then writes in a book a little later on that all Lehi's descendants are wiped out. So that would break the line of lineage. And we also know that Joseph Smith's ancestors came from Great Britain. So a lot of issues there, and that's just one of many. Thirdly, the Doctrine of Covenants. The Doctrine of Covenants is merely a continuation of revelations given to Joseph Smith and some other prophets that are declared to be the infallible Word of God. These are just two of some ones that you can see in there. DNC 27:11 teaches that Adam preexisted as Michael the Archangel. And like I said, this is just one. We'll talk about more in their next time. And then 93:29 teaches that man was also in the beginning with God. Intelligences or the light of truth was not created or made, neither indeed can be. So in other words, what is eternal in Mormonism is what are called intelligences and matter. Both of those are eternal. Matter has always existed. Matter is eternal. And intelligences are just things like basically our thoughts, our beings, our personalities. And those are eternal as well. And when God the Father gave birth to spirit children, who he was once a spirit child of another God at some point, all that did was bring a spiritual incarnation of an intelligence, which was eternal. So man was in the beginning with God, because we always were. And all we did in this life was what we entered into what is called the moral probation. And we'll talk about why that has to happen next time. Last authority is the Pearl of Great Price. It includes extractions from Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible, as well as a translation of some Egyptian papyri, supposedly containing the writings of the prophet Abraham, which is called the Book of Abraham, excerpts from Joseph Smith's testimony and history, and the LDS Articles of Faith. It gives supposed insight on the priesthood and the cosmos and the pre-mortal existence, which we are all pre-existent spirits. The pinnacle of the cosmos is the slowest rotating body known as Kolob, which according to the text is the star closest to where God lives. The Book of Abraham is the only work in the Latter-day Saint canon to mention the star Kolob. And here we read about it in Abraham 3, 1 through 4. Abraham saw the stars, that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God. And the name of the great one is Kolob, because it is near unto me, for I am the Lord thy God. I have set this one to govern all those which belong to the same order as that upon which thou standest. Based upon this verse, the LDS Church claims that Kolob is the star nearest to the presence of God and the governing star of all the universe. Time moves slowly on this celestial body, for one Kolob day corresponds to 1,000 earth years. This is the book of Abraham. This is the actual facsimile that Joseph Smith uses in the work. The problem is it's a fraud. It's a common funerary document. You see, at this time, it was nothing for many of these explorers. The 19th century was a period of exploration, going into Africa and Egypt and the great tombs. And many of these explorers would come back and make copies of facsimiles and stuff that they would find and sell them for money in markets. And Joseph Smith, unlike being divinely given the Book of Mormon, he was just stumbled upon this papyri. In other words, he just bought it from a market. And he found it, and he began to translate it and said that it was the angel of the Lord. Abraham was fastened upon the altar. The idolatrous priest was Elkanah. The altar for sacrifice was an idolatrous priest, and all of these idolaters were on the bottom. And ultimately, Abraham's in Egypt, and these were where God gave Abraham this incredible vision of the premortal existence and all of these things. However, this is merely a book of the dead. This was a book for funeral rituals. And the problem is, we know that that's the case, but when you look at the picture, what Joseph Smith did was the Mormon Church actually showed the article that they had in their archives, and the part at the top there is missing. And what Joseph Smith did was he merely drew pictures of men's heads on the parts that were missing and said that this was the book of Abraham. How do we know that? Because this is the actual document. See, the document on the right is the document that the Mormon Church claims that Joseph Smith got the book of Abraham from. The document on the left is an actual Egyptian facsimile, which was copied that they got the original document from. And the document there on the left is an Egyptian book of the dead about Osiris and Ra. And that's what's happening there. And this is, you can see what Joseph Smith did here in this picture. The top right is the actual facsimile. The one on the bottom right is what Joseph Smith did to alter it and to draw pictures of heads that made it look like a man on the altar rather than Osiris doing the sacrifice in the book of the dead. It was a fraud. A system built on a fraud by a man who spent his life as a fraud, leading people astray. And we'll see next time when we're together just how astray that movement has gone as we get down to the nitty-gritty and look at the false doctrines of Mormonism and try to wring our head around that and look to the Bible and see what God's Word has to say against it. Let's stop there tonight.